through the whole process, when you're actually in treatment, it's you've got goals and, you know, right, chemo, 3 weeks, I can do that, and then I'll have surgery and bang, 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 and you can be positive. And then when it's all over you, and I know that you've said this before too, you kind of get left to your own devices, but then it all catches up on you what's happened. Like I had it over Christmas, I was a bit of a mess. It's just because you're grieving. It's a grief process of that life that's no longer yours.
Kia ora and welcome to the C Word, Kiwis Talk About Cancer, the podcast for cancery people. Today I'm very pleased to welcome to the show a former Canterbury Flames netballer and captain of the Bahrain netball team, Kelly Hutton. Thanks so much for joining me, Kelly.
Thanks for having me, Helen.
Oh, it's so cool to have you on, and I actually really wish you were on to talk about netball because my career peaked in about Form 1. I was always put in at goalkeep because I was tall, but then my final season I was goal shoot and I did okay.
Good girl. I think people would say my career peaked in Form 1 as well, but I've just sort of carried on.
No. Was that, I'm always curious because you are reasonably tall. Whether other tall people were always put in at goalkeep as well when they were younger?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And especially, I think, because when you're tall and when you're 12, like I was the same height now as I am when I was 12, I think. So, yeah. You know, you wanted to play centre, but no, nah, just laughed at you. That was for the pretty girls with the pigtails. It wasn't for the big tall.
It's so true. Centre or wing attack?
Yeah. Blondie. Those were beautiful.
Yeah. Usually called maybe Tamara or,
yeah. Yeah, something like that.
No, there's no sweeping generalisations here, but we're not here to talk about netball, unfortunately. You have had quite a full-on, I guess, 18 months or year following the diagnosis of ovarian cancer. And I think if anyone's not familiar with your story, it would be good to kind of go back and tell us how you were diagnosed.
Right, well, I moved to Bahrain at the start of 2019. I was lucky enough to get a job there with a Kiwi-owned airline. And I guess the first time I sort of realised something might have been up, I was just started getting really, really tired and I was sleeping my weekends away. And it's very easy to put that down to the heat over there because, you know, it's 45 to 50 degrees in the midst of summer. But every year you get a flight home as part of your contract. So I came home in September and you almost do your warrant of fitness. So you go to the optometrist, you had a pap smear due, you go to the dentist. So I went to the doctor, saw the nurse and had my pap smear and we just sort of had a general chat and she was like, oh, you know, how are you feeling? And I said, oh, I'm feeling really good, but, you know, the older you get, this whole, you know, your periods get heavier and stuff and I know it's a real pain. Like I'd had investigations about it a few years before, didn't think anything of it. I said, God, I wish they'd told you. And she said, oh, it might be worth having a chat to the doctor about it while you're here. And I was like, no, you know, I've got time to kill. I was just mooching around. So I went and I did go and see the doctor and I kind of already had a feeling that something wasn't quite right, but I couldn't put my finger on it. So I went to her and presented with the vaguest of symptoms, which anyone who gets ovarian cancer realise they're just, the symptoms are vague as heck. So she sort of said, oh, look, it sounds like you've got constipation. Go home and take some flow. And I was like, oh. In my head, I was like, oh, this has been a bit of a waste of time. But she said, go and have a blood test. So I went and had a blood test and I got the results the day before I flew back to Bahrain and it just said that my white blood cells were up. But I'd had a coldy flu that week, so I didn't think anything of it. And then 2 weeks after that, I was sitting in a meeting at work and I thought I had the flu. I just wasn't feeling great. And that night I went home. I went and played a netball tournament first, which in hindsight wasn't great. I was like, it was the only tournament of the season. I was like, no, it would go down. And I was standing on the sideline with my hands on my abdomen just going, this isn't good. And that night I went home and I thought it was food poisoning. Mm. And I was just in absolute agony. And it sort of went from there, really. I went and saw the company doctor. We initially thought I had a ruptured spleen. We thought I had a condition called costochondritis because the pain that was left over felt like I had a constant stitch, like I was walking around with a stitch all day. And then we both realised, I sort of said to him, I said, look, this is starting to affect my life. It doesn't seem right. He said, look, I'll refer you to a gynaecologist. And it just so happened that one of my colleagues at work, his wife had just been diagnosed with breast cancer and had some tumours removed from her abdomen, and had this amazing Egyptian gynaecologist to recommend. And she was an NHS senior consultant, so I absolutely trusted her, because it's a bit of a free-for-all over there. Like, you just don't know what you're getting. Like, the hospitals are beautiful, but, you know, it's all very money-driven. It's all very public. So I saw him for an investigation. He ordered blood tests and an ultrasound. He wasn't too concerned. Mm. So I went home that night, had my blood test, and then I wasn't feeling great. So I left the ultrasound for a couple of weeks, and then I had it, and then I left it for another couple of weeks because I didn't hear anything. So I was like, oh, well, they would have contacted me if there was anything wrong. My GP rang me. He was great. He was like, you know, what'd they say? I said, oh, they haven't seen anything. I'm fine. He's like, oh, no, it's not how it works in Bahrain. They won't even look at your reports unless you're there in front of them and someone's paying for it. I was like, oh, shit. So I went back, and you know when someone's demeanour's different? He just looked at my results. He was like, right, you're having an urgent MRI tomorrow. I was like, why? He said, oh, and in the same breath, he was like, we're going to have to take out your ovaries. And I'm like, well, why? And he said, oh, well, don't worry. You know, you're 45. You don't need them anymore. And I was like, that was the first, this is just bedside manner in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And I think I just started instantly crying. I was like, there was a little nurse there, and there was no tissues, and she handed me a scratchy old paper towel. And,
oh, no.
And I remember he said, I said, well, what is it? I said, is it cancer? He says, we can't actually say that until we go in and have surgery. I said, right, so I'm having surgery. And so I remember walking out that day, and because of my height, I'm a bit of a freak show at the best of times. Like, I can walk through Westfield Mall and Christchurch and people kind of stare at you for your height. So when you're in Bahrain, where the average height is about 5'2", I was walking around in heels and full corporate gear, and I had mascara all down my face. And
no.
People were just like, who is this woman? So, and I guess the worst part was that you couldn't really, because of he spoke great English, I spoke great English, but our dialects were so different.
Mm.
We really had trouble understanding each other and having a standard conversation. So you sort of just got the bare facts, and the protocols are very different there too.
Mm.
So you don't get a big spread of paper telling you what's going to happen. You're just sort of going in blind. And I was like, but my work was great. So they flew out my mum and my sister, because they said you'll be in hospital for a week. And I mean, the communication was such that it was 2 days until after my surgery, because I was going in for a full hysterectomy, full ovaries, oophorectomy, whatever. And it was 2 days after that I realised that they hadn't been able to do that, that they basically just opened me up. It was too fast spread, and they just shut me back up again. But, you know, so it was like, they come around for their rounds, and the surgeons were Egyptian and German, and I said, the fact that you cut me up, is it terminal? And they said, oh, we don't use that word anymore, but Kelly, we're all going to die one day. And I was like, it was just like,
oh my God.
Oh, it was just getting better.
If it wasn't such a, you know, a difficult subject, it would be almost like a catalogue of comedic sort of disasters.
Oh, do you know what? I had to laugh, and that's what I've done since then. I'm just like, oh, this is just, you know. I mean, that was like, I was too long for my bed, and the nurses loved, like, because having a Kiwi in the hospital was a bit of a, I don't know, they enjoyed it.
Yeah.
They thought, because my eyes were really blue and they didn't really see blue eyes, and I was a bit of a celebrity. And and the best thing was, then they found out that I was a Kiwi, that they all loved Jacinda Ardern. So they treated me almost deferential.
Wow.
Because the mosque had only happened, you know, in the months before, and they just thought our country was incredible and Jacinda was amazing. And treated me super well, and, you know, with extra care. And so, yeah, so then I was on a plane home, because, you know, I couldn't do chemo there.
No.
Without the support. I'd only been there 10 months. And I also had a great network of friends and netball teams, and you couldn't wish that on people that you didn't know. So, yeah, so I was home, and I was lucky that it was quite seamless in terms of getting back into the New Zealand system. I managed to get an appointment with the oncologist on the 17th of December, and I was having chemo on the 19th.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah.
I was very, very, very lucky in that sense. And, you know, so first chemo just before Christmas, and then launched into it.
Wow. I just sort of getting my head around it because I can imagine even, you know, the flight home, that's a long flight when you've got something hanging over your head.
A storm and, you know, there was a rainstorm in Dubai, you know, the biggest desert country.
Yeah.
Never rained. So our flight was delayed and we had to walk to a different terminal. So here was me. I just had an operation.
Oh.
I was, you know, riddled with cancer, so to speak. And they had to, our gate moved and I thought, oh, you know, it's a bit like Christchurch, you know, you move 500 metres down the road, but Dubai Airport is massive. Mm-hmm. So I think we had to walk for 2K. And I was like, do I get a cart? It's just like, you know, but we walked and, but as I say, my employers were very generous and we flew home business class. So if anything, that helped.
Yeah.
But it was a comedy of errors, but yeah.
I have read the fantastic articles by Suzanne McFadden in Newsroom and, you know, your humour does come through. And I keep thinking about when you first messaged me and you said, I'd really like to hear more stories about, you know, like Bob from Mochueca. Bob. And I thought, I love it. So, and his dicky prostator.
Funny because I know that you had David Downes on and... Yeah. You know, one of my friends, it was one of the first things that I got sent was his book. And I sort of thought, look, I approach everything with a bit of humour. It's just how I deal with life. And I was like, but I didn't, because it's such a sensitive subject, I felt really uncomfortable. Because in my first post on Facebook, I said something, I don't know, something about I'd be hairless and, you know, silver linings. And people thought that was extra funny under the circumstances. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to run with it, though.
Mm-hmm.
And then I read David Downes' book and I'm like, he can do it. And it's, with complete respect to everybody else that's going through it, but it's just how it's going to help me deal with it.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so I just started making it public and I've had such incredible feedback about it. Like, I didn't realise people were following along, you know, my friends and family around the world were following along so closely, I think.
I think that's really, because it was similar to how I did it as well. I was really honest on my Facebook of this, you know, when I was diagnosed to going through treatment, posted photos of me. I mean, I was bald as a baby, you know, I lost all my hair. And, you know, I didn't post everything, but I think it almost, I don't know about you, but I almost felt like it gave me a little bit of control over what was going on, how I responded. Yeah,
and I think it's also a bit of the language around kids. Like, it's a bit of a sort of a taboo subject. You don't know how to talk about it, and a lot of the you know, it's always about statistics or someone being diagnosed too late, and you know, and having a crack at the medical system, and which is terrible because it happens. But I just thought, you know, when I got it, I didn't know anything about it. Like, I knew people had chemo and it was terrible, but I didn't know what chemo actually was. I didn't know what it entailed. So I was like, right, well, maybe if I tell people, they can follow me and they can actually get a bit of real life around it.
Mm.
And I've had a couple of friends since who've been diagnosed with breast cancer, my age, who've messaged me and said they felt a lot better about it because they knew someone they knew had been through it and this is what happened to me and that you can actually get through it on the other side. And for that, I'm quite grateful that I did make it so public. Like, people are like, I can't believe that you're posting that. Like, it's such a private, personal journey.
Yeah.
I was like, oh.
It isn't, yeah.
Sorry, this isn't me.
Yeah, I feel the same. And I, because chemo does such horrific things to your body. And I think that for me as well, that I just sometimes had to laugh about it. I couldn't, like, in the moment where, you know, the gastrointestinal issues were, you know, not pleasant, but afterwards you just have to sort of think, you know, for me now, my biggest piece of advice is take the laxatives. You know, do not underestimate just how constipated it will get you.
I'll never say the word I'm shitting bricks about anything because now I've actually done that.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry to the people, but that was the worst bit for me. I'd actually get anxiety because, as you know, whatever drugs they were pumping into me after about 5 days, nothing was happening and you'd feel the stirring and it was pain. It was horrible. It was because, like, as I say, one day I was so bad I was sitting on the loo at 2 o'clock in the morning and I fainted on the toilet, smacked my head on the thing and knocked myself out. I've still got the dent on my head.
Wow.
And I had the most epic black eye for about 6 weeks. I was so proud of it. And it was just, you know, But because I'm living with my mum, so I sold up everything before I left to Bahrain. So I sold my house and everything before I left. So she's sort of been my caregiver. And her biggest fear was that something would happen to me in the middle of the night and I'd call out and she wouldn't hear me. And I was like, it's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. And then it happened. So she was extra paranoid for a wee bit there.
Yeah.
To just come running into my room at night going, Kelly, Kelly, and I'd be lying in bed going, what's happening? You were yelling out. I was like, no, I wasn't. So caregivers have it bad too, you know.
Oh, they do. I had only been with my partner, Ross, for about 6 months before I got diagnosed. And I remember the first sort of couple of rounds where I realised just how bad the constipation was going to be. And we tried it. It was like I'd had flow, I'd had laxative, we'd gone for a little walk around the block. Then he was massaging my stomach. And then I was like, I think you're just going to have to go home and let me, you know, really concentrate on this place.
You almost had to diary it, didn't you? Yeah. I was like, oh, God, it's happening. Like, well, you just want it to happen.
Yeah.
Because you think, God, I had fish and chips on Friday night. It's Tuesday, and I haven't seen those fish and chips.
No.
And they're somewhere in my body. It's just like,
yeah.
Oh, no.
So for anyone out there who's just starting chemotherapy, just take the laxatives. Preempt it.
Yeah. Forever.
Forever, yeah.
But anyway.
Part of your chemo was actually done in lockdown. So you come home and then COVID must have been brewing and then hit. What was that like having treatment during COVID?
I think there was a good thing. I always try and find the positive. The positive was that everybody was at home and I wasn't missing out on any fun. So no one's Facebook feeds were, hey, I'm partying, hey, this is cool. It's like we're all in the same situation. So I was in lockdown too, but just like everyone else. But because my mum, you know, she's in her 70s, she'll hate me for saying that. But so we were both vulnerable. So my sister was doing the whole delivering the groceries and stuff, but we were extra paranoid because, you know, we'd wash everything down. I know lots of people are doing that too, but you really felt vulnerable, like this could literally, if I get this, it could kill me because you're so immunocompromised at the time. But then the good thing was that you actually got to leave your house. Like, mum would be like, oh, when's your next chemo? I was like, oh, it's 2 weeks. Like, she's like, oh, I wanted to go for a ride this week. I hoped it was this Friday. I was like, yeah. You know, it was just actually quite nice getting out and going to see people. But because of my first three, I'd had quite a good entourage of people come and sit with me. And so for the last lot, I was lucky enough because I had great private insurance with my employment in Bahrain. I went through St George's Cancer Care Centre, which is absolutely incredible. Beautiful venue. The nurses are amazing. And I think without your entourage, there was only six chairs. They had to reduce the amount of chairs. So there were six people in there at any one time. And you actually had some really good conversations with people going through exactly what you were. And it was really quite a nice bonding experience. You sort of weren't isolated and sitting in the corner just looking out this window. And you did kind of look forward to it. But I think when I realised I was the most vulnerable was that I did knock myself out over lockdown. I rang my oncologist and I said, look, it's probably quite a bad concussion. I'd been about 7 days and I'd had concussions before. And I said, I think I might sort of need to go to hospital. And she said, no. She said, the risk is too great. So she said, you have to weigh up whether you've got a head injury or whether you want to risk your life with COVID. And I was like, oh.
Wow.
I don't want to make that decision today.
No.
So it was probably a bit of pressure on mum too because she was on her own. So if anything went wrong with me, it was just that whole what could happen. I mean, it all went through great in the end. But it was just an added extra layer of pressure that you didn't really need at the time.
Yeah. I've heard that from other people and other people overseas where COVID's a lot worse where, you know, you've got, we know, when you've been through cancer, you know what that stress is. And then there's just this extra layer of it with COVID because there's this extra sort of what if above everything else. Yeah.
And you know that when they're talking about the vulnerable people, that's you. And you just, I've never been a vulnerable person in my life because I've always been fit and healthy and never had sick days. So it does make you more empathetic we have more empathy for people with, you know, chronic illnesses and things like that, like the things that people go through. You know, what I've been through in comparison is minor compared to what people who live with it for years and years and years is. So,
I want to touch on what you said there about being fit and healthy, because this is what I always find fascinating about cancer. Because I was 37 when I was diagnosed, and I was I wasn't an elite netballer, but I, you know, I walked and went to the gym. I led a reasonably, you know, clean cut lifestyle. I wasn't, you know, my party days were well behind me. But training and exercise and those sorts of things have been really key for you.
Yeah, they have. So, I mean, I rolled into that job in Bahrain and I said to them, I said, oh, you've got a good one because I'm never sick. I've had one sick day in 5 years. If anything, I won't be sick. And I was there for 7 months and history knows now. But, yeah, so before, I finished playing netball, probably the last time I played for Canterbury was 2010. We won an NPC championship that year, so it was a nice way to leave. Mm. And I was also 36 years old, so it was time for me to step aside and let the young ones come in. So after that, I started doing the odd half marathon and a bit of adventure racing. I had a couple of guy mates that would drag me out and make me do this terrible mountain biking, and they'd show me where I was going and I'd cry. I'm like, I'm not going down there. And they'd really push my boundaries, you know, and they were great. And then I had a couple of girlfriends who did the spring challenges down in South Island, which were, you know, big adventure races. And yeah, I was fit and healthy. And my nana, she's 93. My other nana passed away at 99 and a half. And I always just thought I had this big, long life ahead of me. And I was the last person that I thought that would get sick. Yeah. And I think that's probably what hit a few of my friends more too, because they couldn't believe it was me as well, you know. So, but I'm lucky I had that background because with netball, obviously you train very, very hard. There'd be times we had a trainer, an Australian ex-league player called Jason, who when I was in the Flames would absolutely flog us. And, you know, he'd find a little 1 kilometre circuit and you'd have to run that 6 times and getting faster and faster every time. And on the 6th time, he'd say, right, girls, you go out there and leave everything out there and you'd come back and you'd be, you know, when you're starfish on the ground and you can't breathe, and you'd be like, well done, you'd be well done. And then he'd say, now we're going to do one more. And you're like,
no, Jason.
I know, exactly. And like the first thing would be the stream of expletives coming out of my mouth going, yeah. I didn't sign up. But then you did it. And when you're lying selfish on the ground, you'd be like, my body can't do that. And so what it taught me was that your body is an incredible machine that you just don't know how far you can push it. And I'm lucky that I learned that I could push it. So when I got to the chemo, I kind of had that mental mindset that was, okay, my body's probably been through worse physically, so let's just see what we can do with the chemo. Mm. And it was just a nice mental fallback.
Yes.
I think.
And I know that you've been doing all sorts of things post chemo to sort of keep your physical activity up. And I think I love this photo of you, and I will put the link up on the show notes of you in an American hot dog outfit.
Oh yeah. Well, my last name is Hutton.
Yes.
And the Hutton Sizzlers were a very popular barbecue addition for years. So I've taken teams all around the world with netball and just social teams. I've been to Spain and things. I always call my team Hutton Sizzlers. So I was like, oh, well, I'll add the hot dog suit this time.
It's amazing. So you ran in this hot dog suit?
I did not run, no. We had to walk. It was a 12-hour. You had to have someone from your team on the track for the 12 hours. Yeah, so I was nowhere near capable of that. So I tried to walk for the first, I did a couple of laps every hour or something, but I ended up walking 21K over the course of the day. But it was just such an amazing, like the Cancer Society do incredible things, and it was just, everyone was there for the same sort of reasons, and it was really nice to be part of a sort of an event like that. But in saying that, you know, it takes me a good 4 or 5 days to recover from something like that, and I do push myself a bit hard, and I've been, crash and burn has quite a regular thing in my life at the moment. I go good for a couple of weeks and then sleep, can't talk to anyone. Just don't come because I'm just exhausted. Yeah.
It's really weird, isn't it? And because I, something I read that you had said to, in Suzanne McFadden's article, and I really related to it, was that especially around being active and sort of, I guess, feeling, you know, strong and fit, is that you said you have these moments where you feel like you have your old self yeah. back.
And then I have lots of moments where I realise that my old self is gone. And they're the tricky ones, you know. It's because yes. having your old self back is, it's passing, really. And the unfortunate thing for me is that a lot of my friends are fit. You know, and I try and keep up with, well, I don't, they're really good. Like, they know that I'm not where I was before. But, you know, when you tell people to go on ahead and they do that because you've asked them to, then you realise how far behind you are, that you can't keep up with them. Whereas a year ago, you would have been up with you with them and laughing and joking, but you're sort of slogging away at the background. And that takes a lot of getting used to. And it's a bit of a, that's the saddest bit for me, is that, I don't know, you just realise what you've lost and that it's not coming back as quick as I thought it was. So maybe it never will, but I'm still really lucky. Like, I can still walk a half marathon. Like, I mean, I'll walk it, but it was, you know, in the old day, like, oh my God, we did that Queenstown thing and it took us 4 hours to walk it. And we were coming in with all the marathon runners and people were like, yes, marathon runners. And, oh, you're a walker. Oh, well done. Just walking it, not like these guys who run. And I was like, you don't know what we've been through. And it was just a real reminder to me that everyone on a marathon course, a half marathon course, has got their own story. And you don't know the amount of commitment and, you know, that people have done to get there. So it's like, just cheer for everybody. You just don't know.
It is so true, because I did the, what did I do? It must have been the 11K traverse a couple of, was it last year? No, it was the year before. I have no concept of time anymore. But I did it and I walked it and it was emotional because, okay, so it wasn't a half marathon. But at that point, if I'd thought about it, that year before, I couldn't walk her to the letterbox without needing a 4-hour nap.
Correct.
Because I was in the middle of chemo.
Yeah.
And so you're right. Okay, I may not have been, you know, sprinting at 11Ks, but I felt quite emotional at the end because it was, yeah, that.
And
wow,
so should. And if you had I've a sign through, on your front
yeah.
saying, I had chemo 6-7 months ago, people would be cheering for you. Like, so yeah. if people would cheer for you, you should be cheering for yourself like that, you know? And you say, and like yeah. you just said, it's that whole language again, like you said, it wasn't a half marathon, it was just 11Ks, but just yeah. 11Ks yeah. is a massive effort. And we've just got to,
yeah.
and I'm, you know, I'm the worst person at doing it, saying, oh, it was just a half marathon and I just walked it, you know, like a little loop.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know.
I think it's really hard when you have been a high achiever in some part of your life, whether it was your work or, yeah, you know, athletics or something, and you go through this enormous event that alters you in a way that is very difficult to describe, and not feel a sense of loss and sort of grief that person has actually is
absolutely.
Gone.
And that's, and I can be honest and say that's probably what I've struggled with the most the last 3 months, I think. It's through the whole process that when you're actually in treatment, it's, you've got goals and, you know, right, chemo, 3 weeks, I can do that, and then I'll have surgery and bang, 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 and you can be positive. And then when it's all over, and I know that you've said this before too, you kind of get left to your own devices. And then it all catches up on you what's happened. Like, I had it over Christmas, I was a bit of a mess. It's just because you're grieving. Mm. It's a grief process of that life that's no longer yours and never will be, and yep. starting this new life. And it's like looking in the mirror every morning and it's, who is this woman with short hair and, you know, that's got no yeah. control, and I've put on weight through chemo and through menopause yeah. and, you know, and it's, I don't recognise myself anymore, and it's learning to love that new person. But you have to go through this process of, okay, this is who I am now, embrace that person, she's gone, but you can still bring aspects of her with you. And it's, yeah, it's a real mind, I don't know, it's not very nice. It's not very nice, but you've got to go through it, I think. It's a bit depressing.
Yeah. It is very challenging.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's, and I guess that's the heavy side of it. I mean, I think that, you know, all the tools that we can use to get through it, you know, the humour or, you know, being active and those sorts of things. And then the other side of that, those scales, is the grief and is the difficulty and is the anger that why on earth has this happened to me, you know, all of that stuff. And I think that can be difficult for people to understand that that's what we carry
Absolutely.
With us.
Yeah. And it's hard to talk to people because it is a depressing subject, so you don't really want to talk about it with your friends because you want to be talking about upward stuff. But it's also that, I call it that toxic positivity that goes with it, you know, like, you know, when you're bald and people say, oh, but you've got a nicely shaped head, you know, how many times do you hear that? And it's positive, but it's just like, oh, you know, that's not really what I want to hear today. Or, you know, I said to someone, it's really hard not knowing, you know, I've got a 47% chance of making 5 years. And I said that to a girl. And she said, oh, yes, I know. I know how you feel. I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. And I'm like, no, it's a bit different. I said, you haven't picked out your, paid for your funeral plot or your burial plot. You know, it's, but people don't know what to say. So they just sort of say, it's like, it's when you've got that limited time on the planet, well, you don't know. I could live for 10 years. I could live for 20 years. I don't know. It could be back in a year. I don't know. That's the thing. It's
and that's so hard. Yeah. And that is so challenging to live with. And I think when you're young, you know, younger, when you've had it, you know, because I think we are around the ages that we are a minority in a way of getting cancer at this age. And so it's really challenging to try and push through that. Because I worry about it a lot. Will it come back? What's that pain?
Oh, all the time.
You know, and you're like, why am I still coughing?
You kind of think that you're immune to everything. Like, I got a bit of a cold last week. I was like, oh my God, what is it? And it's like, it's just a cold. You got used to getting them all the time. You're not immune to every single disease on the planet anymore. But you kind of think, that's the thing. You think about every little twinge, like, oh God, this is the end. Which is funny. I love about it, but when you're in it, you're just like, it is a constant battle.
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. And I think you've described it as a loaded gun, and I feel that too, that you're sort of walking around sort of, you know, every day is great, and every year that you sort of clock up that's past your diagnosis stage is fantastic. But I haven't found the secret or magic to being, for it not to worry or for me not to think about
that's
it.
That's very true. It's like you can't really make a long-term plan. Like, I decided very early on last year that I won't need my KiwiSaver anymore because the chance of me making 65 are, you know, very slim. And now I've got that, the other side of, well, what if I do? Here I am happily spending it and, like, taking all this time off work and enjoying a bit of life. And then I could be, this could have just been a wee blip in my health history and I'll end up destitute when I'm retired. So should I keep putting money away? I'm like, I don't know, every decision. And that's the thing, I think if when you're not sick, you just, you hope for the best and you're like, I'm going to live to old age because why wouldn't you? And that's how everyone, but make the most of your time, you know, don't waste your life, but live, think long term. But for, I think when you've got the threat of recurrence hanging over your head, which you do, it's year by year, 6 months, you know, that's all you can think ahead. So it's hard to plan. It's like, even going back to work, I'm like, well, will I be wasting my time sitting at a desk when if I get recurrence in a year after that, then I've wasted that whole year sitting in an office.
Yeah, it's so difficult, isn't it? And then I think I keep, because I've really been, I don't know why, but the past sort of few months I've been, I just, yeah, that fear of reoccurrence has really reared its head for me. And I keep trying to tell myself, don't let cancer take up any more of your mental space. I just, you know, I'm trying to be positive and stuff, but I don't know. I don't know how to move past that fear at the moment.
But that's the thing, but I don't know if counselling helps or it's just something that's there. I don't know, I've never had counselling. I had counselling once and he was exactly like I thought he would be. He had long socks and Roman sandals on. And that was after a work incident. And I was just like, I can't go back to counselling. But it's, you know, the Cancer Society offer it and it's there. Yeah. So sometimes maybe they give you the tools to compartmentalise it. I don't know. Maybe you and I actually just bite the bullet and go and do it. Ask for help.
Or if someone has the answer for us.
We tell everyone it's there and we're just like, oh, I don't need that. But, you know, maybe you just do need a couple of sessions. Or we, you know, it's just to, I don't know. It is, but it is tough because, like, the recurrence rate for me is 70 to 80%. So it's not a matter of if but when it comes back for me. But you just still try and be positive and hope for the best. Like, you know, like I said to I was talking to my friends the other day and I was saying about moving out of home and I was like, well, it's just in case, if it comes back next year, everything's under control here, I've got it set up, mum's here to help me out. And they're like, well, that's no way to think, is it? And I was like, yeah, but it's preparing for the worst and hoping for the best. Like, it's just, I don't want it to happen, but it's, could happen. I don't, you know, I'm not negative Nancy going, oh, it's going to come back in a year. It's just, you just got to be prepared for it and roll with the punches, I guess.
I think that's exactly, and I think that's exactly it, is that when you live it, that you're not being negative. It's actually just a reality. And I think for our loved ones or people outside, that's quite frightening. And if you're sort of quite, oh, well, blah, 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 and they're like, what?
Well, I've got this really dark sense of humour and I forget that it's quite shocking to people. Like, I was even on Christmas Day, I said, oh, why don't you guys tuck in? And I said, well, I'm going to go first because I haven't got much time left to muck around. And they were like, whoa! And I was like, oh, no, I'm just joking. Like, it's just like, oh, I was like, sorry. I should.
Yeah. Don't mind Kelly. Just ignore it.
I was talking to some friends. I'm like, oh, we should put together, you know, $50 a month and in 5 years' time we can all go to Sydney and have a reunion. I said, that's a great idea, but I absolutely can't guarantee I'll be here in 5 years. Like, can we make it two? And I think just me saying that, it's a horrible reminder. You don't want to say that to your friends, but that's just the way it was. I was like, shit, guys, can we bring that with it? And they got upset and I was like, you know, laughy, ha-ha, but still upset. And that's the worst bit, is that you don't want your friends and family to be upset because of what you're going through. And you see your friends crying and they don't never show it to you. You know, like I don't show my tears to them. I try, you know, you're always strong and positive in front of people. But that's not to say you don't go home and cry in the shower and cry sleep at night, because you do. It's just, you know, you can be as positive as you want, but as you say, it's a heavy old burden to carry. So,
yeah, absolutely, yes. So, what are your plans for this year? What have you got on? Are you going to be doing any more marathons or exciting hot dog outfit events?
Love me a bit of fancy dress.
Yes,
I've got a couple of road trips coming up. So, I've got a reunion with some London flatmates. So, I'm going up to New Plymouth, and I'm going to drive the Forgotten Highway and do a few things like that. And we're going up to the Hokianga with my friends in Kerikeri, but I'd love to do, my younger sister wants to do a 10K. They want to do the Christchurch 10K. So she's not a runner at all. And I'm sort of trying to come back. I don't think I'll quite be ready by April, but there's lots of little 10Ks I want to do. I'm not quite sure my body can handle a half marathon. I did crash and burn when I tried to train for it last year. So I think I've learned my lesson. But then I was thinking about going back to work in autumn, sort of have the summer out, just because I miss, you know, using my brain. And I think if I'm at work, I'm not thinking about heavy stuff all day. But I do love me a jigsaw. I've got addicted to jigsaws. It's so sad. I'm the saddest person on the planet. I could sit home. If there was a job that you could just do jigsaws and get paid for it, it'd be great.
There must be. If anyone knows of a jigsaw testing job, let us know and we can hook them up with Kelly.
I just like the logic and the, I don't know. The good thing is about work is that I could actually, because I liquidated all my assets before I went away, I don't necessarily have to work a lot. So I could go and be a warehouse assistant that's just Siri telling me she didn't get that. I could be a bus driver for all I want. So it's quite cool actually having a clean slate and deciding, you know, what do I want to do? But I'd still like to be part-time because I do sleep a lot. So, yeah, that's the thing. And it's also that going to an employer and saying, look, I've had cancer, you don't want them to say it's going to come back because then they might not employ you. But I like to think that I'd win them over with my wit and charm first.
Exactly.
Oh, you will have you. Then we'll look after you when you get sick.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. All these things you don't think about. Yeah.
No, not at all. Hey, thank you so much for sharing your story with me. It's so cool to talk to you and hear more about, you know, your experience. And I wish it had been all about netball. I reminisce about those Form 1, my glory days on the court.
Hey, it's never too late. It's never too late. You could be a wing attack centre.
Exactly. Yeah. We could put on a blonde wig, get out there.
Thanks so much for joining me today. The C Word airs every Sunday on Auckland's Planet FM 104.6 FM or online at www.planetaudio.org.nz/the C Word. Thanks for joining me, and I'll see you next time.
too hard to breathe. Yeah. Oh, my baby's crying. Oh, it's mother too. Chamber, too ready.
point when I need everybody to get to the dance floor. It's like that, y'all. That, y'all. That, y'all. That, y'all. That, y'all. Like that, y'all. Like that, y'all. That, y'all. Like that, y'all. Like that, y'all. Like that, y'all.
I came to have a party. Open up the Bacardi. Feeling so hot tamale. Boy, I know you're watching me, so what's it gonna be?
Yeah.
Purple taking me higher. I'm lifted and I like it. Boy, you got me inspired. Baby, come and get it if you really feeling me. My night. No stress, no fights. I'm leaving. Baby, come and get it, let me give you what you need. It's a special occasion, maybe it's a passion. A cause for celebration, I ain't gonna let nobody's drama bother me.
Your beautiful skin. knife is in my hand, but I won't cut you, I won't touch your beautiful skin. Your beautiful skin.